Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Mike Costantino sitting across from me. This is Steve Williamson.
Good morning. Good morning.
We have one of the country's most noted economists with us today.
We do. We have Dean Baker with us this morning. He's written extensively on the bubble economy over the last decade.
One of the economists that most predicted the housing bubble.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think anyone was probably did a better job of predicting that, and also guessing at the impact that would have on the rest of the economy.
Online, they have a thing where he's reading. And of course, we're talking about him like he's not here. He's online. He's online with us.
Say hello, Dean. So.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. In 2006, they have the little clip online about him predicting the. Certain economic disasters that came true. But I love the titles of his books. First, I want to talk about his I guess it's his old blog on the American Prospect, Beat the Press. I kind of like that. I like his End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. This is, I guess, his most recent book in 2011. Taking Economics Seriously, which is, once again, I think in 2010, kind of shows how you have a layman's view of things that, you know, that most of laymen don't take economics seriously because it's hard, or you guys talk out of both sides of your mouth. I mean, it's hard to understand. The one I liked also was The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy and The Conservative Nanny. I like this one, The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. That was 2006 or 2007, but quite frankly, I don't think things have changed very much. At least they haven't in Arizona.
Who said that there's a socialism for the rich and capitalism for everybody else?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They only call it socialism when it's when some poor guy gets a free meal.
In Europe, we've seen very divergent approaches to the collapse of the economy, to the kind of worldwide recession. And in Europe, it's been, I guess, all austerity all the time. In the U.S., under the Obama administration, it's been austerity combined with stimulus. We just had an election, right, Mike, in Europe. In France, particularly.
Hollande won, yeah.
You know, it's the first socialist in since 1981. What's your take? What's happening with... How is the austerity theory of solving the economic collapse, how is that working out? It seems to me that people in Europe are abandoning it.
Yeah, well, it's not working out very well. You're seeing rising unemployment across Europe, the Eurozone countries certainly, and then the UK, which is not in the Eurozone, but it also has decided to go the austerity route. And, you know, the basic story was that they're going to cut spending, raise taxes, and the notion was that that would somehow make businesses, consumers confident, sufficiently confident, they'd go out and invest more and spend more, and that would boost the economy. So it always struck me as kind of perverse. I mean, we know, you know, if you cut spending, you're pulling money out of the economy. You used to be paying people to teach, to be firefighters, to build roads, whatever it is. You're paying people to do stuff. You stop doing that, that's pulling money out of the economy. Pretty straightforward. Same thing if you raise taxes. People seem to understand that with taxes, but they seem more confused when you say you stop paying people. That pulls money out. It's the same story. And then the question is, can you offset that somehow? And the proponents of austerity said, well, we understand that, but if we do this, then the markets are going to be so confident that interest rates will fall, bond prices, stock prices will soar, we'll get all this new investment, et cetera, et cetera. We haven't seen that. So, you know, they've tried this in a big way across Europe, as I was saying, the Eurozone and the UK, and they're all back in recession now. And now the people have a chance to vote on it. And in France, you had Sarkozy, who'd been president, was elected by a big majority back in 5 years ago, thrown out, lost not a huge margin, about 4 percentage points. And then perhaps at least as important in Greece, you had, which is in the thick of this, I mean, Greece, of course, being the classic crisis country, they really did overspend. They really did have a deficit crisis. And now they have severe austerity. Their unemployment rate's about 20%. And perhaps even worse, it's not projected to turn around anytime soon. That's not my projections. Projections to the International Monetary Fund, European Central Bank. They're projecting that they're going to have another year of recession after this one. And even in 2017, they're still going to have an economy it's about 10% smaller than it was in 2007.
Is that Greece or is that all of Europe?
That's Greece. That's okay. Greece. And in their elections, the two parties that had supported the austerity package, their two mainstream parties, it would be kind of like the Democratic Party and Republican Party in the U.S., both agreed on a set of policies. Well, they had elections, and the two parties together got over just over a third of the vote.
I mean, that's real quick. I want to do a quick comparison of Greece and the U.S. I've heard that the people are worried about, you know, obviously what happens there gets reflected in our stock market, but that if you have a $100,000 house and you make and you owe a mortgage of $100,000 and you make $100,000 a year, that's the U.S. economy. We have a debt and a deficit about as big as our of what we make. In Greece, it was way out of line. Those numbers were way out of whack.
It was about 160% of their economy, and even more importantly, well, a couple things that were more important. One was that it had very large deficits, much, much larger deficits on an ongoing basis. Greece also doesn't have the same sort of diverse economy that the U.S. has, and it doesn't have its own currency, which has been a big issue here. So if it had its own currency, it would have a way out of this. It would lower the value of its currency. This is often confusing to people, but this happens all the time in countries that when their goods become uncompetitive, the value of their currency falls. We have that option. UK has that option. Greece doesn't have that option because it's in the Eurozone. So there were a lot of things that are very, very different. So when people try to say we're like Greece, they're basically telling you they don't know what they're talking about.
Okay.
We lost, about 7.5 million jobs when the recession hit. We had a stimulus that produced a couple of million jobs. What should we do now? In other words, you predicted the housing bubble, but that's in the past. What should we do now? What are you advising the country to do to get out of the situation that we're in?
Well, it would be great if you get more stimulus. Obviously, politically, that's not going to go anywhere, at least not anytime soon. So Congress isn't about to do a lot more stimulus. The central bank, Federal Reserve Board, could be more aggressive. I won't go into details on that. I'll just say there are some more things that Bernanke could do. He could have been worse, but there's more he could do to try and boost the economy. But one of the things that, you know, I would like to see discussed more, I think I talked about it last time I was on your show, is work sharing. This is a policy that's been used with great success in other countries, most importantly Germany. But the idea is that you try to give firms incentive to reduce work hours rather than lay people off. So if they were going to lay off 10% of their workforce, you say, how about instead of laying off 10% of your workforce, why don't you have people work 10% fewer hours? And the government picks up half of the lost wages. And Germany, it's been incredibly successful. They actually have a lower unemployment rate today than they did at the start of the downturn. And it's not because of their growth. People talk about Germany's booming growth. That's not right. Germany's growth has been about the same as the U.S., give or take a little bit, obviously, depending, you know, what the numbers come in for last quarter. But basically, their growth has been about the same as the U.S. The big difference has been that they've persuaded employers to keep people on the payroll, working fewer hours, rather than lay people off. And I should point out, this actually there was a provision in the extension of the payroll tax cut bill that got signed by President Obama back in February, passed by Republican Congress, or Republican House, I should say, pointing out it's bipartisan. And the provision said that states, we already have 23 states that actually have work-sharing programs as part of their unemployment insurance system, that if states get more people to take that up, that basically the money they spend on work-sharing will be refunded to them. So this is a great incentive, and I can't tell you offhand whether Arizona is one of the states. It's 23 states. I know California is one, New York. You have a lot of big states, Washington State. A number of big states are in there, and people should check whether Arizona is. But this is it's just saying that if you can get employers to keep people on the payroll and have them work shorter hours rather than laying them off, the federal government will pick up the tab for that. So that's a really good way to try to keep people employed, keep the unemployment rate down. And in this case, states have a very direct incentive. The more people they have taking advantage of that program, the more money they'll save.
So you can look across over to Europe, and you can see that the program works in Germany, and yet I don't believe Arizona has that program. And when we have it here, it's a very, very limited program. Why won't we learn from looking around the world about what works and what doesn't work? It doesn't look like austerity works.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's a real conservatism in thought, and I'm saying conservatism in thought. I don't mean like liberal conservatives. I just think, you know, people are very reluctant to adopt new ideas. And what's kind of funny is, you know, I've worked on this here, trying to, you know, promote it among people in the policy community. I've talked to a number of members of Congress and staffers. One of the people that who's joined me on this is Kevin Hassett, who's a conservative economist. He works at the American Enterprise Institute. He was an advisor to Senator McCain when he was running for the Republican nomination back in 2000, and currently he's working for Romney. You know, he agrees with me on this, that it just doesn't make sense. You know, as it stands now, the government says, okay, if you lay someone off, we'll pick up half their salary for, you know, a year or 2 years, depending how long they'll get benefits. But if you want to instead keep people working but reduce their work hours, well, you're on your own.
God, that makes so much sense. And yes, we just had some research here. Our researcher let us know that Arizona is one of the 23 states that takes part in that. But I suspect, and we're talking,
it's Steve, so minimal, it doesn't really have an impact.
Steve is asking why, and it's another government intrusion, as it were, at least that would be seen by some conservatives, into private enterprise. And
people don't believe in unemployment insurance, long-term unemployment insurance here. They want to punish the unemployed for being unemployed. It's astonishing.
Well, you have that, but what I'd say is that, you know, let's leave that one aside. Maybe you do want to punish them, but for the moment, at least, you already have the unemployment insurance, so it certainly can't be any greater intrusion to say, okay, you know, instead of paying someone after we lay them off, we're going to pay them for, you know, working shorter hours.
Well, it's just a much better program. I mean, you keep the people employed. It means, I mean, if you've ever been out of work, I've been out of work. It's devastating.
It's depressing, and the prospects for folks out of work for a very long time, as many people in northern Arizona are.
Well, the good news
is
that
you're out, the longer you're out of work, the less your prospects you are of getting back and getting a decent job.
The good news is
exactly
that workfare is being taken up here, at least including in one of in John McCain's backyard here. To what extent it's being utilized, a word I'm not fond of using, but being used is the question, I guess.
It's very hard for us to understand, you know, what it is Mitt Romney thinks, but one of his compatriots in Bain Capital has written a book. The man's name is Ed Kennard, and it basically justifies the whole system as we see it now. And do you have a take on the book? You're quoted in the New York Times article talking about the book that's coming out.
Yeah, I read through an advanced draft of the book, and it was really quite striking for a couple of reasons. One is it's just the extent to which Mr. Kennard, and I have no idea if his views reflect Mitt Romney's. I mean, as a business associate of him, as I understand they were personal friends, but whether, you know, whether they share views,
happen.
Who knows. But in any case, his the extent to which he just has ignored what's happened around us. So here we are sitting here with, you know, the unemployment rate, official unemployment rate, 8.1%. We know there are millions more that have dropped out of the labor force. 4 or 5 million people want full-time work and can only get part-time jobs. I mean, it goes on and on. So we really have a disaster on our hands, and he seems almost oblivious to it. He blames us all on government policy to get low-income, moderate-income people into home ownership, which is, you know, just nonsense. And he actually, you know, I was sort of struck by it. I was reading it closely, and he says, well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac securitized bonds for bad loans. Well, I happen to know that wasn't true, so I looked at his source. His source shows the opposite. So, I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling. Here's this guy who just seems to have totally missed or just misrepresented, you know, again, I don't know whether he believes the stuff he writes or whatever, you know, what exactly happened. But the other part is glorying in people getting rich. You know, he has some line in there saying that for every dollar that an investor makes, society gets $20 of wealth. And that's a very, very convoluted claim. I mean, A, the 20 to 1, I have no idea where he gets that ratio. But even if you talk about society benefiting from productive investment, which of course we do, I mean, you know, if we get, you know, someone comes out with a new line of computers that's better existing lines or software, you know, of course there's benefits to that. But the point is the vast majority of investment doesn't have that character, particularly in his line of work. I mean, this guy's in financial engineering. So what they do, half the time, they'll take over a company. It's absolutely standard in private equity to load it up in debt. And the reason why they do that is the interest they pay on that debt is tax deductible. So almost from the word go, they're going to come out ahead because they take over these companies. They don't care if they go bankrupt. A lot do. They know that. And, you know, the fact that they're paying interest rather than having profits paid out in dividends, that means that they're having higher profits. That's at the taxpayer's expense. They haven't created a penny. They're just doing financial engineering. And that's a lot of what private equity does. I'm not going to say it's everything what they do, but that is a lot of it. So the idea that somehow we should all be thankful that he and, you know, Mitt Romney and other people in private equity are clever at finding tax dodges, that's kind of crazy.
And Ed Kennard is at Bain Capital now. That's Romney's old company?
I think he's founded his own firm now, but he worked there, so is my understanding. I could be wrong.
Well, the other thing is on Kennard, by the way, the definition of him is a falsely supported rumor. I mean,
but it's going to be an influential book, don't you think? I mean, we're going to see conservative. He's going to make the circuit, and we're going to see every conservative commentator in the country.
It'll be on Fox News 24/7.
Well, he'll get out there, and I think in some ways I think that's good in the sense that it would be good to get people's reaction to it. And I hope that, you know, Governor Romney, not that he has to, you know, comment on everything that his former business partner is saying, but, you know, it would be interesting to clarify his views. Does he think the same, or, you know, does he have a qualitatively different view about the economy and the world?
Well, it gives a target, I think. Like you say, at least it gives us conversation.
The problem with Romney is,
I think it's completely off the mark and wrong in just about every way, in many ways quite offensive. But, you know, he's running for president. I think people have a right to know.
So you'd like to get it out there so that we can argue about it and discuss it and let it be made really explicit what's thought at the top level. Well, they really do believe that the American economy can't really exist efficiently without them, and that they should be rewarded in this kind of unlimited way.
It's striking because, you know, like no one I know is arguing that, you know, we're going to have the government take over, you know, private enterprise and, you know, not let people make profits. The question is, you know, do we benefit from letting these people run wild? And that's kind of what we've been seeing, run wild in the sense of literally disregarding laws. And that's pretty much what we saw in the last, you know, the last decade, was certainly a lot of the stuff around mortgage finance. And, you know, that's quite an argument to make in my view, but, you know, he's obviously comfortable making it.
All right. Real quickly, I guess not quickly, one of the things I got out of one of your introductions to your book was the impact of the last 25 years. And a little bit about the difficulty of writing history. You're an economist, but your books are historical. You are an historian in some ways. So let's go back a little more. We're talking about current stuff, and that's good, and it's what's impacting now. I mean, as current as yesterday and the election. But what about the impact of the last 25 years?
Well, we've seen a large upward redistribution of income over this period. So, you know, from the 40s up through the 60s into the 70s, everyone more or less gained equally in economic growth. And for most of that period, certainly the 50s, 60s into the early 70s, we had very rapid growth. So we both had relative equality and also very strong growth. They really changed in the 80s. In the 80s, you began to see a sharp divergence where those at the top were getting most of the gains. Those at the middle and bottom were getting little or nothing. And that story's really persisted through most of the last three decades. The one minor departure from that, I don't know how minor it is, but the late 90s, you did see good income growth up and down the income ladder. So you saw even people at the middle and bottom were seeing good wage gains, 97, 98, 99, 2000, this period when the unemployment rate got down to 4%. But that's really the exception. And, you know, the question is it going to continue this way? Are we going to continue to see those at the top get most of the gains from growth?
I think there's agreement on that. I have a letter at home from John McCain that outlines how the rich are getting richer and the income gap and how it's grown. There's agreement on it, but what
causes it and what can we do about it?
What can we do about it is where...
Well, you know, again, I think it's important to understand this is driven by policy. So you have some people just say, oh, well, this is just technology, it's globalization. And, you know, this is one of the things I argue in much of my writing, certainly the books you mentioned, that no, it was not just technology, it was not just globalization, it was the way we structured technology, the way we structured globalization. So just to give a few quick examples, deregulation of the financial sector wasn't just deregulation. We had very specific types of deregulation. We didn't end too big to fail insurance. So basically, the way I always put this is that the banks wanted, what the financial industry wanted, was they wanted insurance that they didn't have to pay for. It's sort of like you or I started up a fireworks factory in our home, and we're just paying, you know, residential insurance on it. You know, well, we're ripping off the insurance company. In this case, that's what the banks were doing, but they're ripping off the taxpayers, and it blew up, and, you know, we got the tab. We had to bail out the banks. So that's one part of the story. Another part, our trade policy. Is very deliberate that we put our manufacturing workers in direct competition with the lowest paid workers in the world. That was quite explicit policy. You know, people say, oh, it's a bad outcome. No, that was the intention. That was the point of the policy. We wanted our auto workers, our steel workers, you know, relatively high paid workers in this country to compete with workers in China that are getting paid $1 an hour, in some cases less, and naturally you lose your job or you get much lower wages in that story. We could have had our doctors, our lawyers, our economists, we could have structured trade agreements to put our most highly paid workers in direct competition. We didn't do that for the most part. For the most part, our most highly educated workers still enjoy substantial protection. So it was a conscious decision. So I can go down the list. There's lots of ways in which we structured policy to redistribute income upwards. A lot of the story, I think, is just reversing that. One last point I'll just mention in this vein. CEOs, you get outrageous pay, and people get angry, you know, CEOs get outrageous pay, and, you know, that's unfair. We can argue whether it's unfair, but it's more than just unfair. It's really corrupt. Because CEOs in European companies and Japanese companies, they're not getting tens or hundreds of millions. They get good pay. They get $2, $3, $4 million. But you look at the head of Toyota, Honda, you know, big successful companies, they're getting nothing like what CEOs get in the U.S.
It's controlled by regulations there, isn't it?
No, it's not controlled by regulations. It's controlled by the shareholders. Here you don't have effective shareholder control. You have boards that are largely appointed by the CEOs. They're their buddies. You get people that get paid hundreds of thousands a year to go to 3, 4, 5 meetings, and they just go, sure, we like the guy who gave us this, you know, this perk, and you want $20 million? That's fine. And that's a really corrupt system. That's not a market. That's corruption.
I guess I was reading that the CEO compensation went up 15% in 2011 and 28% in 2010, and it averages $5.8 million. But that's sort of a low-end figure on it.
Well, I was watching Freightline, and Geithner had his chance to rein in CEO compensation, and according to this TV program, he didn't take it. And sure enough, Wall Street decided not to rein in CEO compensation. I guess there was a hope that the negative political consequences would, and what had just happened would have sobered them up, and they would have voluntarily saw the error of their ways or the inequity of what they were doing and stopped the 4 and 5 and 600% increases, other, you know, higher than the highest paid working person. But they didn't do that. Those bonuses and those salaries continue today.
Yeah, absolutely. And the story was, you know, at the point where they were basically on, you know, on the dole, they needed the bailout money or they were out of business. You could have given them any conditions. You could have said, okay, we want to break up the banks. We're going to put serious caps on compensation. There were some, but they were a joke. Everyone knew they were a joke. And you could have really reined that in as a permanent matter. Instead, they just, you know, they put in some wording that has said it wasn't serious, and now things are just back to the way they were, you know, before the crisis.
Let's go back to the banks for a minute. Too big to fail. In Cottonwood, or in the area here, they're talking about the Move On is wants to do demonstrations against Bank of America again, and Bank of America is too big to fail, and their policies and their compensation packages for their CEOs they haven't lost step since the crash.
That's right. And Bank of America, you know, really, it's kind of a poster child because it's done just about everything. You know, they bought up Merrill Lynch, which, you know, was in the middle of issuing, you know, hundreds of billions of mortgage-backed securities with junk mortgages. They were involved in all sorts of derivative trading. They've been in the middle of a lot of the worst abuses in the foreclosure, robo-signing. So a long, long list of things to say about Bank of America. And, you know, the idea that they should be broken up, I mean, you know, talk about a good candidate. It's hard to think of a better one. So they're definitely a too-big-to-fail bank. As it stands now, they're the biggest bank. Well, you'd have to look carefully. J.P. Morgan's kind of neck and neck, but at least they're either the biggest or second biggest in the country. And no one thinks that, you know, if we're about to go under tomorrow, that we would just let them go under. So I think it's a great idea. Focus on breaking them up into, you know, their component parts and, you know, get them down to size so they're no longer too big to fail.
Buffett talked about that we settled our bank thing 3 years ago, and Europe has never done that, which is one of the reasons for the changes, or the difference between us and them as far as our recovering economy goes.
Well, you know, we have different problems with our banks than they do. They're a much more bank-centered economy. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I was always poo-pooing the idea we're going to be like Japan with a lost decade. We could be, but not for the same reasons, because banks don't play the same role in the U.S. economy. You have many more firms that have direct access to capital markets. In other words, they just issue bonds, they issue commercial paper. They don't, in that sense, need the banks, whereas in Japan, certainly the largest firms, a Sony or a Toyota, can go directly to capital markets, but you wouldn't have a firm that, you know, employs 500 people, you know, issuing shares of stock, which you actually might in the United States.
Right. There's nothing between them and the banks to get the capital.
I was thinking that the sort of thing that Bain Capital does and Kennard does is always, we're always told that it's making the system more efficient. But if you ask the question, who's it making the system more efficient for? It's, you know, the stockholders in Bain Capital.
Well, it's not clear it's making more efficient, though. I think we're way too generous if we make that assumption, because much of their money has nothing to do with making the system more efficient. As I say, much of it is simply finding tax scams.
It makes it more efficient for them, though.
Right? Well, more profitable.
Yeah, more profitable.
That's the distinction in general. When someone says making it more efficient, I usually think that's good. Then you say, okay, well, who's benefiting from that efficiency? But when you make it more profitable, they could just be, you know, they're just taking money out of someone else's pocket, or can be. And that's certainly, you know, when it's a tax scam, then, yeah, they're just taking money out of someone else's pocket. Ours.
Government creates jobs too. I think. I mean, you know, we're just going to wind up here. We're almost at the end of this. But I was listening this morning about there's 17 inspectors, well inspectors, oil well inspectors in Colorado for 47,000 wells. If there was ever a need for some government jobs. And of course, people are worried that these fracking things are happening in their backyard. They got oil rigs between buildings. They got them in the schoolyard, not in schoolyards, but behind schoolyards. Make a comment on that government. It's okay for government to hire people.
Well, I mean, you know, the idea of government doesn't create jobs. I mean, you know, we have tens of millions of people employed as teachers, firefighters, jobs that actually most people respect. I mean, most people respect those people. They work for the government, and most people understand they do valuable things. But, you know, it's the specific case you talk about, fracking, it's actually very, very interesting because, you know, for the most part, it's not the big companies that are doing fracking. Most of these are smaller upstart companies. The reason why I say that is because it's a classic case. Suppose that they do, you know, the thing blows up and you get a lot of workers killed or pollutes, you know, people's wells. A lot of cases, these companies are just going to go out of business.
Right.
Guess who suffers from that? That's
so they,
not the free market. That's just saying people could poison other people and kill other people and get away with it. That's not the free market as I understand it.
And there won't be any way to get compensation. Of course, if you
exactly, that's the point. That's the point.
We're going to have to continue this because we're at the end of our time.
Yeah, so thank you very much for joining us from D.C. on Democratic Perspective. Next week we have another distinguished economist, Jamie Galbraith from the University of Texas. He'll be talking to us about similar issues. The week after we have one of the bloggers, most famous bloggers in the country, Digby, will be talking about the politics of deficit hysteria.
And you can hear it all on vvid.org. Thanks.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.